Good morning and welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. On today's show, UNM music professor Richard Antoine White spent his early childhood homeless on the streets of Baltimore. He is now the principal tubist for the New Mexico Philharmonic and the first Black musician to earn a doctorate in tuba performance. His new memoir is I'm Possible. Richard Antoine White, welcome to the show and congratulations on your memoir.
Hello, Stephen. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Richard, you've obviously achieved great success in the music field. So my question is, why switch gears now and write this book?
The stars have actually aligned, I think. You know, with COVID, I think the entire world is looking for hope. So this felt right. This endeavor started, I think, just a little bit before COVID with the documentary and then bled into the book. Personally, I feel like it's time. I feel like our world and country is in need of a reevaluation and change. And so if I can be of any kind of service to promote the kind of change I think we need, or individuals seeking that kind of change, I want to be instrumental in helping everyone achieve it, whether you're at an advantage or disadvantage. We all could use a little hope.
So I have to ask then, what are the kinds of change that you're thinking about when you say that?
Oh, man, how much time do you have?
not a lot, because I want to get to your story, but...
Okay, so I believe in the three C's: choice, chance, and change. I believe what we all ultimately want is a chance to make the right choices to see the kind of change that we want. And then last but not least, I get tired of because of this and because of that, we can't do this. I want us to adopt a model of in spite of this, in spite of that, in spite of this roadblock, how about we just show you that we can do it? Those are some things I hope to ignite with the book and the time frame of now. I believe the time is now, because I think I read a quote somewhere that says, procrastination is the arrogant assumption that God and the universe owes you more time to do what you already had time to do.
That's right. We know we can't waste it. So that leads to one question I had, which I think you kind of answered, but it's the title, I'm Possible. That's susceptible to so many different meanings. I'm wondering why you picked that title and what you intended by it.
Right from the start, it just jumped out. Even when we were exploring titles, it means against all odds. Impossible turned into I am possible, meaning that we have explorations like going to the moon before we made it to the moon. And now we've canceled so many programs because it costs so much. It's not about the billions of dollars that it costs. It's really about doing the impossible. And this title fits that. My life against all odds. If you were a betting person, you wouldn't have bet on me succeeding. But that makes it exciting. So the title Impossible is just that.
So you're proceeding against the odds, I think, started right at birth, because you weighed 1 pound, right? And I'm not sure exactly how old you are, but around 50 years ago, the chance of a 1 pound baby making it had to be less than 50%.
Yes, and I'm just below 50, a few years. So I think back then, the whole NICU unit was a different story, and I weighed just over a pound. That's how small I was.
Wow. So you must have had like a million tubes in you.
Oh, yeah. There's a segment in the book where I imitate my adopted dad, Richard McLean Sr. Lord, boy, you had all those tubes coming out your nose, out your ears, and everywhere. I used to feel so bad for you. I'm sure I'm glad you made it. He's Southern, obviously.
Yeah. I like the imitation. So your next challenge is almost unbelievable. You have a confrontation with rats, and you're not really old enough to fight them off at that point, right?
Unbelievable story. Yeah, I still bear the scar of that. I was in an abandoned, burnt building. I guess my mom set me there thinking it'd be okay or safe while she went and served her addiction, her battle. And I guess the neighbors heard me crying, and they were aware of our situation. And so my uncle, Ricky Jr., the son of Richard McLean Jr., as you can see, there's a lot of Richards in this family, came and shot at the rats. And he was so scared because he didn't think. He was very reactive, and he thought that he could have possibly damaged my hearing, but he didn't. And the only reason I know this story is because he told me.
Right. So I kind of left something out of the continuum, which is when you leave the hospital, you leave with your mom, but you don't go home because there is no home.
Yes, I experienced what I call intermittent homelessness, which means that, you know, some nights I slept on somebody's couch or somebody's floor, every now and then a bed, but we didn't have a key. We didn't have a lease to any place. And I, as far as I can remember, when I was old enough to walk, I always had a trash bag over my shoulder with my belongings going from place to place because, unfortunately, my mom had me at a very young age. We grew up in a really, you know, traditional American home where there were a lot of do's and don'ts. And if you did the don'ts, you had to go. You were reprimanded. And that didn't go so well with her being pregnant with me so young. So her addiction with alcohol led to some really tough times and some really challenging things. But ultimately, I view her as a hero because she did one of the hardest things there is for a parent to do, and that's to give their kid up so that they can have a better life.
And that is amazing. And the other thing that comes through in the book that she gave you was this sense of attachment and loving. And you had the same feeling toward her. So in some ways, she gave you so much, even though in terms of endangering you, I mean, that certainly was off the charts and wrong.
Yeah, I think we shared that responsibility. You know, I had some normal activities like any other kid. I would play. But the addition to my daily activities would be to try to find some coins in the gutter and make my way up to the open market, buy some chicken wings, chicken gizzards, whatever I could afford. And sometimes I'm sure I couldn't afford anything, but the kindness of the people at the open market saw that I probably needed to eat. And then my last quest of the day was to find my mom. And most of the time I was successful, but sometimes I wasn't successful. And that led to me sleeping on cardboard under trees, abandoned houses, etc. So that sense of every day I had something to do, which is find mom. And she had to find me. And I'm not going to say that it was all scripted. I'm pretty sure as a kid with no rules, you know, no brick and mortar, I probably roamed off a lot of times when I shouldn't have.
Yeah, so what were you doing? I mean, you're 3 and 4 years old. I find it hard to believe that you were able to survive, really, on your own.
I walked everywhere, barefoot. Sometimes I would look for food in the trash can. I would go to the water fountain in the park, you know, try to wash up or have a drink of water. I would look for my mom, as I said before, or I would, you know, sometimes look in dumpsters because, you know, people would make fun of me. I didn't mind walking around barefooted because I would find shoes in the dumpster and then put newspaper in them so they would fit, and they would always fall off. So I just said, the heck with them. I just don't need them. But if enough people talk about you and tease you, you're going to try to figure it out. Well, maybe I should get some shoes. But ultimately, I decided that shoes just weren't for me.
So the final straw on being homeless seems to be when you were discovered inside a vestibule in an abandoned building during a blizzard, right?
Yeah, I think it was actually, I think we can look it up. I think it was some kind of historical blizzard in 1978.
Oh, no kidding.
I mean, I think I remember the police trucks riding around in like blue ribbon bread trucks because it was the only thing that could move in the amount of snow we had. I think the whole Northeast got hit. This is one of those days where I could not find my mom. It was freezing. I banged on the door of some relatives. And to me at that age, I probably thought I was banging on a door like Hercules, but it was probably really insignificant. I'm not even sure if they heard it or not. I found a vestibule, crawled in it, fell asleep and passed out. Obviously in that temperature, it's just not healthy to be uncovered or not with heat. And I'm not even sure how I was found, but the next morning I woke up. Authorities covers more tea than anyone could ever possibly drink. And everyone was scrounging, trying to figure out what the next steps would be because they thought that if this happened again, I might not survive.
So I want to talk about those next steps. But before I do, let me mention that I'm very pleased to be joined by Richard Antoine White, Dr. White is a professor at UNM. He's also the principal tubist for the New Mexico Philharmonic, and he's also the first Black musician to receive a doctorate in tuba performance. And you're listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas, and my name is Stephen Spitz. And Richard, what happens next is that you go to live with the family that actually took your mother in when she was young. And that ends up being a terrific thing for you.
Yes, it's a fascinating sequence of events because the foster family that adopted my mom eventually became legal guardians of me. So in essence, to explain it to the listeners, my grandparents became my mom and dad eventually. I think the world of them, they had some pretty intense rules and regulations. I think in the book, I call their house Buckingham Palace to begin with.
I got such a kick out of that because that's from a child's perspective. But looking back on it, it isn't actually Buckingham Palace, right?
No, but to me, when I was reflecting, it reminded me of unlimited resources. So I didn't know people ate three meals a day. So I would eat a, bologna and cheese sandwich and stick half of it in my pocket. And they were like, if you want another, just ask for it. And I would be like, yeah, right. I'm going to stick this sandwich in my pocket. They had rules, or, you had to take a bath before you got into their clean bed with their clean sheets. I would end up putting on my dirty clothes and sleeping on the floor after that bubble bath and PJs.
Yeah, your story about the first bath is pretty funny. I mean, it's like your first bath.
Yeah.
By Vivian McLean, your adopted mother.
I mean, I was clean behind the ears everywhere, man. And I was like, ew.
Another great story that you tell in your memoir, Impossible, is that first shopping trip to Kmart.
Oh, that was unbelievable. So, going from Goodwill, giving what everyone has to hand-me-downs, to going shopping for school and being in Kmart and having Vivian look in my face because I was torn between, do I get some high-top shoes? Do I get low-tops? And then she's like, how about you get both of them? Well, you got some blue pants. Let's make sure we get some brown pants. It's going to be cold. Let's make sure we get some corduroys. Let's make sure we get some long johns, which is another story. I was like, some what? And at a moment, I'm so happy. And then we're checking out, headed towards the counter. I had a panic moment. I was like, oh, no. Who's going to pay for all this? And, during that time, we still use paper checks. So she whipped out a paper check, paid for it, and the rest was history. Unfortunately, when I went to school, I was really teased because Kmart, you don't get Jordache, you don't get Nikes. I didn't care, man. I was like, I'm like living the life here.
They weren't Air Jordans. And actually, the kids probably knew they were Kmart, right?
Oh, yeah. They said, look, man, he got some fake Nikes. It's a check instead of a Nike sign. I was like, what are you talking about?
So one thing that struck me reading your memoir is, so you achieve all this success, including a doctorate from a very good school, probably the best music school in the United States, Indiana University. And yet as a student, to begin with, you're not a very good student. You don't seem to really care.
Well, my mind is street oriented. So there's always this hustle side of things. And you're right. I might be a little biased. I think Indiana Jacobs School of Music is the best music school in the country. I was not your traditional student. How about I say that? And the one story, I don't want to give too much of the book away, but, I remember sitting in class with my friend Dante. This is a little bit pre-college, but not much changed when I got to college. And he's like, man, what you get on the math test? I was like, a 72. He's like, man, I got a 98. You need to study, man. You need to do better. This is just not good. And I said, hey, Dante, come here, man. Let me talk to you. Come over here. He said, what? And I said, look, when we graduate and we walk across the stage, your diploma going to say the same thing as mine. They're going to say you got a 98 on the math test. And he bust out laughing and said, oh, my gosh, he's actually right. I need to practice trumpet more.
So that brings up a sort of the next event I wanted to come to, which is how do you come in contact with musical instruments?
That was fourth grade. I think this tradition still happens. some music educator will come to the school and demonstrate on all the instruments. And that happened at Cross Country Elementary School in Baltimore. And the only reason I started playing trumpet, because I looked at Dante and said, hey, man, yo, we got to pick the trumpet. It only got three vowels. It's got to be easy. Boy, was I wrong. That was the wrong assessment. So we both started playing trumpet. And you're right. I was really struggling in school. And kudos to Richard and Vivian McLean, because they decided that if I was going to change my act and turn things around in fourth grade, I was going to repeat fourth grade. And they took my trumpet and said, well, if you want this trumpet back, you're going to have to change your academic progress. And I wanted that trumpet so bad because band gave me a sense of belonging. It was something I belonged to. I felt, you know, like I was achieving something significant there and collaborating with others, that I did everything in my power to get that trumpet back. And I've never repeated a grade since.
So, but in the end, somehow, Richard, you switched from the trumpet to the tuba. And my understanding is that could even be a more difficult instrument. So how did you come to the tuba?
Once we graduated from elementary school, we got to Falstaff Middle School. And man, I was like number 18 out of 32 trumpets. And I was like, this just isn't working.
18 out of 32.
Yeah. And so I looked up and saw this like Frankenstein contraption and the sousaphone. And it was only one. So I said, I don't know what that is, but I want to play that because there's only one. And bear in mind, this is sixth grade. So at that point, if you're a traditional sixth grader, you're not big enough to hold the sousaphone. So it's set in this Frankenstein contraption and you would crawl up under to sit in it and play. And I never looked back after that. And so I started playing tuba. And the interesting thing is, you know, if you read the book, you'll find out later, how did I make all this progress? And when I got to Baltimore School of the Arts, I didn't know how to read music because, and I'm dating myself, I learned how to read on a cassette tape. So when I learned to play music, it was a cassette tape. You put it in this machine, you press play, and it said, hello, welcome to the tuba. This is B flat. Boop. Pause the tape. When you have mastered B flat, continue. Boop, boop. Hello, this is B flat and C. And so that's how I learned to play tuba.
So you didn't read music, but in the classes, weren't there music sheets that you were supposed to read?
Yes, and my band director took by what is called rote. That means they played it on the piano and you played it back. I really wasn't reading. It would be like someone reading a book and telling you to repeat after them.
All right, so I want to come back and talk to you more about the Baltimore School for the Performing Arts, because that's also a great story. But before I do that, let me mention that this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to be talking to UNM Professor Richard Antoine White. Dr. White has written a book called I'm Possible. He is the principal tubist for the New Mexico Philharmonic. He's also the first Black musician to earn a doctorate in tuba performance. And you mentioned the Baltimore School for the Performing Arts, and this is one of the premier arts high schools in the United States, maybe in the top five. And first of all, how did you get an audition? How did it happen that you even got the chance to go there?
By chance, I showed up to the Baltimore School for the Arts on crutches, because the reason I wanted to audition is that I broke my hip. I was going to go to a vocational tech school, become a carpenter, and play football. If you haven't seen me, I am 6'5", 340 pounds. So I was meant to be a football player in some ways, but the tuba changed that. I showed up to Baltimore School for the Arts on crutches with a sousaphone wrapped around my body, the bell over my head, and I'm trying to pull on all these doors and none of them are opening. Finally get one door open, walk in, and the director just happened to be there. The school is supposed to be closed.
The director of the school?
Yes, the director of the school. And he says, what are you, the director of the music department at that time, what are you doing here? And I said, I came to audition. And he said, well, auditions was yesterday. And I boldly looked him in the face somehow and said, but I'm here now. He said the audacity and the determination led him to say, all right, we need to hear this young man. Went upstairs. I played a little Mozart thing that I had. And afterwards, he put some sight reading in front of me. He said, do you know what this is? And I said, yeah, this. He said, but do you know what note name that is? I pushed down my first finger and I said, it's this, man. He said, yes, but do you know what it's called? I said, man, it's this. And he said, okay, let's try this a different way. If I play this on the piano, can you play that back? I was like, of course. And I played it back and he said, hold on. He went and talked to the other professors in the school and said, you must be the luckiest kid on the planet. We're going to accept you into the Baltimore School for Yacht. Statistically, in an audition season, they may hear 600 kids. Out of that 600, they may accept 35.
Wow. So this becomes a great break in your life because it's not just music. It's a general education that's really superior.
Oh, yeah. I think most schools in our country should just simply model the Baltimore School for the Arts. They're not without their problems, you know, especially socially with diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging happening now. We're all trying to figure that space out. But in terms of academics supporting the arts, it's second to none.
And your classmates, so there were some incredible classmates of yours that you become friends with, and they're famous enough that listeners may know who they were, right?
Yes, I went to school with Tupac Shakur, Jada Pinkett Smith now, married to Will Smith, and right now his memoir is right next to mine. So I'm saying, Will, move over a little bit, please.
So you're still together.
Yeah, Tupac was very instrumental in expanding my historical knowledge. He always preached to the students in the cafeteria during lunch period. He was very knowledgeable of American history in relation to the Black Panthers. I think his mom was a Black Panther. And so he encouraged me to read, to know my history. And he was so articulate that I believed him and researched a few things. And Jada was always a star. You knew they were going to be stars. They were best of friends. So they gave us this hope and this knowledge that, hey, we could be stars too. They led by example for sure.
But still, in terms of your schoolwork, my impression from the memoir is you're still sloughing off a lot of it. The only thing you're not sloughing off is the tuba.
Right. I had already had it in my mind that I was going to a conservatory.
So you have this conversation, though, with I think your mentor's name is Ed Goldstein. And he says, yeah, you can be good, but if you really want to make money and be in a symphony, you got to be great.
Oh, he was more blunt than that.
Oh,
he said, yeah. Okay. He said, I think you'd be a pretty good tuba player, but I don't know anyone that's hiring good tuba players. I mean, it was no misinterpreting that, you know. And then it was a very pivotal moment in my education. He said, you know how much I make doing this after I pay for parking? I get here. I'm not making money. This is my way of giving back. And yet you consistently refuse to do your homework and practice and waste my time. That is really hurtful. And I never wanted to disappoint him again.
And another big event is you listened to a performer named David Federley, who sort of opens your eyes to the beauty of a tuba performance, correct?
Yes, I had never heard tuba like that. I mean, and that's... I hope people don't get offended. I tried to be clever and wise about the titles of my book. You know, this first time I heard the tuba and it sounded like Yo-Yo Ma. I was like, wow, I didn't know tuba can be played like that or sound like that. And so I was so amazed at this sound. I was scared that I would forget it. It was my goal to sound like that. So I went and got a job at the Baltimore Symphony Meyerhof. This is the home of the Baltimore Orchestra, so I could hear him play every week. And so every week I would hear him play, sneak in, hear the concerts. And then after every concert, I'd be in the back of the hall asking him questions. How'd you do this? Or how is this? And this part, you took over the orchestra. How can I do that? And he eventually got to the point where he's like, how about I just give you the code to the back of the hall? You can come back when you want. So it was a very amazing relationship.
So you go on to study with him at the Peabody Institute. And then, as we mentioned earlier, you go on to Indiana University. You get a master's degree, and you end up getting a doctorate in tuba performance. But at all this time, you're still actually trying to get a job with the symphony. And there aren't that many jobs for tuba players in symphonies, right?
There are. There were some pivotal moments along the way in my development. My very first lesson with David Federle, he said, I just want you to know, I'm going to have to tell you in 2 years if I think you can make it or not. And I just want you to know, I'm not going to lie.
Wow.
At that moment, I learned that the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off. But you'll be better for it. So I have to thank him. And ultimately, 2 years came. He said, good job. I think you can do this. Let's go. And then he told me something else. He said, I've only won one more job than you. All you have to do is win one. And I thought, I can do one, man. Just one? I can definitely win one. So that was my mindset moving forward as we auditioned for Indiana. And I completed my master's. I'm auditioning, taking whatever orchestras audition and summer festivals that could come open.
So the whole book is one about perseverance, really, and overcoming obstacles. And I know that you auditioned, I think, several times, even for the New Mexico, what was then the New Mexico Symphony. And I guess I'm going to ask you for a takeaway, which is, you know, how do you overcome your failures? How do you overcome your shortcomings and actually put it together so that you eventually succeed? A lot of us have goals, but we don't always score the touchdown. How do you do that?
I have an acronym for failing. I think success and failure go hand in hand. No one is immune. There are three things that we all have to share. One, we all start living and dying the moment we're born. Two, no matter how successful or rich you get, the one thing you can't buy more of is time. And three, we all will experience failure in one way or another. So failing to me is finding an intended lesson in needed growth. And every time I fail, what that means is that there was something I needed to know that I didn't know that I now know so I can succeed.
We are going to have to leave it there. We have been talking with UNM music professor Richard Antoine White. His new memoir is I'm Possible. Thanks also to my producers, Elias Henley and Roman Garcia. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Chebecki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of the show are available wherever you get podcasts. Archives of past shows are at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.